Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime.
Welcome to another episode, a live episode of Surviving the Survivor, the podcast that promises to bring you the very best guests in true crime. And I say this a lot because it's not a tagline. It is reality. Tonight's panel, go anywhere between here and Mars. And if you find a better panel anywhere on list than this, you will get your money back, even though I don't know how much you've paid, but you will get your money back if you find a better panel anywhere. New York police, they appear to have cracked a 13-year-old cold case. Police say that Rex Huerman, you know the name, that he is the accused Long Island serial killer. We're learning more about his life behind bars, the women who came in contact with him recently, and the other woman, his wife, who now wants nothing to do with the now 60-year-old former Manhattan architect. On tonight's show, she'll be here in a moment. Laura Ingle is currently a crime reporter for News Nation based in New York City. Before that, she worked as a correspondent for Fox News for 20 years. She began her career in radio. She worked for the powerhouse KFI in Los Angeles. She made her name during the Scott Peterson case, an all-around great person. I moderated a panel with her and Kerry Rawson at CrimeCon, and we've become good friends ever since. Paul Cellino, if I'm saying that in a proper Italian way, he's the man who comes to us in the hat. He was the first and remains the only private investigator to receive board certification as a criminal profiler from the Academy of Behavioral Profiling within the International Association of Forensic Criminologists. The bottom line is this guy is the real deal when it comes to profiling. He's a current president of the International Association of Forensic Criminologists. He's also a past winner of the International Investigator of the Year, and he's co-authored 5 professional textbooks, A Wrongful Conviction, An Investigative Guide, and a Biography. Randy Zellin, a true mensch and a trooper. This guy just flew back. I asked him to come on the show. He says, I'm in Denmark, I believe it was, but I'll be on your show. Not only that, the guy has COVID. We hope he's feeling better, but you know what? This guy's a gritty New Yorker. He said, I'm coming on the show anyway. He is one of the finest criminal defense attorneys out there. He's tried cases for more than 30 years and has done so against both the DOJ and the SEC. And he is an adjunct professor at Cornell Law. He's been on Fox News, Fox Business, the whole Magilla, you say it, he's been on it. And then another legend in the house tonight, retired Las Vegas homicide detective Phil Ramos was present for Tupac Shakur's autopsy, which is why we had him on to discuss Tupac. But he's also had a 3-plus decade career. Detective Ramos also worked undercover narcotics. He infiltrated the Cuban mob. He's 3-time Las Vegas Police Officer of the Year and a native Las Vegan, which is a little rare these days. A quick reminder, please, if you can, support us on Patreon. You know, I was feeling bad until I was listening to NPR and they're doing their annual drive. And NPR only exists because of some help. And it does cost quite a bit to put all these hours of content together. So if you can help in any way on Patreon or YouTube, it is much appreciated. I understand if you can give us a 5-star on Apple Podcasts, you'd be surprised how far that goes in getting us sponsorships and advertisers. Since we are talking about LISC today, I want to, by the way, I think Laura is here. I'm going to bring her in. Laura, don't worry. I gave you a beautiful intro, told the crew all about you. You've got a little, you got some birds chirping. So if you could just mute while you're not talking, okay. Laura, I'd appreciate that. And we'll get right back to you in a moment. But since we are discussing LISC today, the Long Island serial killer, that is Rex Huerman. I always like to start with the victims. Melissa Barthelemy, these are the ones he's been charged in. Megan Waterman, Amber Lynn Costello. And now we find out that he's a prime suspect in the Maureen Brainerd Barnes case. To you, Paul, your first time here, just from a kind of a macro perspective, when you heard about Rex Huerman, I'm sure your profiling instincts kicked in. What do you make of him from kind of a macro perspective?
Well, he's a pretty disagreeable fella, to say the least. not a very nice man, regardless of what he's been accused of doing. He's kind of classic almost, you know, kind of loner, white guy. I got a marriage that's, I wouldn't say on the rocks, but estranged in the house. Based on his decorating taste alone, I'd find him guilty probably most times. He's New York Post went crazy today with all the firearms he had in his house. And I might add most of them were probably legal. And he didn't shoot anybody. So I don't know what the whole point of the article was other than he was a gun collector of some sort. But, you know, this was a pretty easy one to solve. If they'd have worked it like they should have worked it early on, they could have probably solved this many years ago.
Yeah. So, Paul, just to add on to that, it was an absolute debacle from an investigative standpoint. Do you put any of the blame, which I guess is deserved, on the previous, you know, authorities in Suffolk County for that?
I want to tell you, my experience with this is police departments do not want to ever say we have a serial killer on the loose. I mean, they will do anything to avoid that, because once you drop those magic words in a press conference or in some other local radio show or whatever, now you got to respond and you got to put together a task force and you have to spend money. And we all know that the victims of most serial killers are generally prostitutes or street people or drug addicts or somebody that no one's going to miss too rapidly or care if they are missing. They're kind of glad they're not around asking or stealing money from them. So it's a pretty classic case. It was eminently solvable early on, but no one really wanted to put the work into it.
And I don't want to date Paul in any way, but he's been doing this since 1981. And
a very long time.
And he's so old school, Paul, I'm going to call you out on this. He actually may light up a cigarette out of frame. When I was first starting out at MSNBC, I'm just blanking on his name right now. The foreign correspondent would always do his live shot from wherever he was in Istanbul or whatever bombing he was at in Beirut. And he would have a cigarette behind his back with the smoke kind of wafting up. So when I saw Paul doing that,
60 minutes.
Yep. All those guys. Yeah. Edward R. Murrow. But Laura, do me a favor. You're out there. Tell me, what is the scene like? Let people know. I'm going to play your video in a few minutes, but you've been covering this case. You had a chance to go inside the jail. What have you seen? What have you learned that's of interest?
Well, I want to let you know, first of all, we are standing outside the Suffolk County Correctional Facility right now. It's a little dark, but right here behind me, you've got the barbed wire. You've got this massive jail complex that is so large that it has footprints in two towns, Riverhead and Yaphank. Now, Rex Huerman is being held in the Riverhead facility, which is the older facility, and it was completely full. So for security reasons, we were not able to go inside that one, but we went into the duplicate of that, and we walked through, and you'll see the tape of what it looks like inside to see what his new home is like. Obviously, a very stark contrast to his life before, working as an architect in Manhattan. And while his house in Massapequa Park was not, you know, a glorious huge mansion, it was certainly a lot bigger and a lot nicer than what he is experiencing here. And that's what we came here to find out. We had the opportunity to have that cable news exclusive. And, you know, we wanted to see, this is a big guy, right? He's 6'4", 280. What kind of cell is he in? How big is it? How much room does he have to move around? He doesn't have much. And what kind of services are being provided to him? Oddly enough, he gets a haircut every week if he wants one. That was one thing that we learned. You all saw the new haircut.
By the way, they're awful haircuts, but go ahead.
Well, and I asked the sheriff, who picks that haircut? Did he choose his own style? Apparently, all inmates are allowed to choose their own style. I'm not sure if he said, you know, a little around the ears or what happened there, but that was the style that he chose. So he does have that option to have a haircut every week if he wants. He has the opportunity to go around the recreation yard, and he doesn't have a lot of room to move, so he's just been doing laps inside of this kind of big square that is a basketball court. He does have the meals provided to him. And one thing I asked the sheriff while I was here filming, I said, you know, he's a big guy. And I was looking at some of the other inmates who were watching us film, who were much smaller than he is. And I said, so do those guys get the same types of meals that this big guy gets? And they do. He doesn't get anything different than anybody else, which is, I'm sure your panel knows, is pretty standard procedure. I just thought it was interesting just to think about how big he is, how much he must eat, and what he's getting. So he has to get extra food at the commissary if he wants.
He's not going to be that big by the time he goes to trial. He'd be about 210.
And the other
Go ahead, Laura.
I was just going to say, one of the big takeaways, and you've probably read about it, but I was really trying to get the information while I was here. He's had two visitors. One is his attorney, Michael Brown, who's been here several times. And then there was another person who came twice, about a couple of weeks after his arrest, and they will not tell us who it is. They won't say if it's a man or a woman. They will only say that they went into the visitor center. Rex Huerman came out to see this person. There's no glass in between the two. They are allowed to do a handshake, a hug, or a kiss. It was a handshake. And we don't know much beyond that. They said if they told us the name of the person who came here, their lives would be turned upside down. We know it is not a family member. It's a mystery guest that he has had. And that is the only other person that he has seen. He has had a lot of requests from journalists and from true crime fans who have written to him and have tried to get in, but he has refused all other visitors.
Excellent reporting as always. I'm going to mute you, Laura, so you don't have to keep doing that yourself.
Okay.
It'll be easier for you if I do it. Laura is not only one of the best crime reporters in all of America, but she is an awesome person. And I'm so glad we finally got to meet at Crime Con, where she and I were able to get on a panel, which she moderated. Laura moderated with Kerry Rawson, and I just checked on Kerry today, and she is doing well, kind of hunkered down for the time being. But Randy Zellin, by the way, it's a classic news tease. I'm going to make you wait a few minutes before we play Laura's prison, before we take you inside the jail, and then we'll have Laura explain that. But Randy, we break news here on STS all the time, so you don't have to watch. I won't say. Oh, by the way, Laura Ingalls on News Nation, which does some of the best true crime reporting, and her report is going to be on tonight. I think it's at 10 p.m. When she comes back, we'll have her give you the exact time, but make sure you check her out. She'll be on Ashley Banfield at 10 p.m. this evening with that report. Randy, we just heard, in even according to the New York Times, they've said there's only been two visitors, a chaplain and his attorney, but now Laura is telling us someone else was there. What's your, we've got Phil Ramos from Vegas. What's your betting money on who that person might have been, Randy Zellin?
I don't know. And I'm going to divert your attention away from this mystery guest and suggest to you that we should not discount this investigation, which is now morphed into the cache, I think that's the right word, of guns, a number of them that have been alleged to be illegal. To me, in this case, there is built-in reasonable doubt because, as Paul indicated, this investigation was so botched over so many years. You have 11 victims, of which three and maybe a fourth, Mr. Huerman, has been or will be charged with. So the built-in reasonable doubt is, wait a minute, did he kill all of them or did he kill none of them? How is it that he could only have killed some of them? So I think this investigation now opened up by Nassau County is a backstop, because if they can get him on the illegal gun charges, it's kind of like Al Caponing him. Just in case we can't get him on what we really want to get him on, we at least know we have him on the illegal gun charges. So I would not immediately dismiss the fact that there's an open investigation by another jurisdiction into these illegal gun charges.
And what Randy is talking about, which we're going to get to, but I've got the finest guests in all of America, so they're on top of it already. But Suffolk County basically handed over Rex Huerman's guns to Nassau County, the adjacent county in Long Island, and they're running their own investigation. He had something like 287 guns, and Laura can definitely clarify that for us. Only maybe 90 were their permits for, I believe, if I'm correct about that. And so Nassau County is investigating. And so what Randy is alluding to is that if they can't get him on the murder charges, Randy, you got to understand, is a defense attorney. So Randy's like, hey, if you can't pin him for all 11, there's a chance this guy gets off, which we'll go circle back to and ask Randy about that. There's a little thing called DNA, which Randy will slap me around about because he'll have an answer for that as a defense attorney. But Phil Ramos, we have not heard from the literal Las Vegas legend here. We're finding out a lot about this case and what's going on. It's actually surprising how much we are learning, but he is spending most of his time in that building, all of his time in that building behind Laura, because he's in jail, but he's spending most of his time inside of there reading about his case, reading about himself. And as Laura pointed out, he's gotten a ton of requests from both media and, believe it or not, true crime fans to come visit him. He has basically told them all to buzz off. But what about that? And this is probably a question for Paul, too, that he is reading pretty much all about himself. The Daily Mirror ran a story with a photo of him taking a selfie of himself. Do these serial killers, in your experience, do they love to look at the at not only their handiwork, but the media attention that they get as a result of it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Paul can tell you, a true serial killer, man, they are a breed apart. They are just very unique in their thinking and the way they conduct themselves in their everyday life. You know, you talk about living one life in the dark and the other one out in the open. It's I'm not surprised that he's reading about himself. Ego plays a lot into their mindset with serial killers. But, you know, a true serial killer, by definition, he doesn't go out and find these victims because they're easy to catch. They're all easy to catch. They're not easily missed, as it was alluded to earlier. That's why so many serial killer victims are people in high-risk lifestyles. You know, many of the victims that we have had out here in Vegas were sex workers. And because of the fact that they are sex workers, people are very hesitant to report them missing. I had one that was a victim of a serial killer, young working girl, and her mother didn't report her missing for a year because of the nature of her work. But the day that she picked up the phone and called, I knew, boom, right away, this is the girl that we were investigating. And I asked, I said, why did it take you so long to report her missing? It was, well, look at the life that she leads. She'll pick up and, you know, fly to Monte Carlo with some multimillionaire as part of her work, and we won't hear from her for a month. So the fact that he's reading about himself just goes to that point that he wants to compare himself to Dahmer and all these other people and see, hey, am I really that good of a serial killer? And time will only tell.
They love it. They love the publicity. They love the attention. I guarantee you he's got 20 letters from chicks who want to date him and marry him and be with him and write his life story. It's never ending with these guys, all right? They, once they get caught, they love being the star of the show. Love it. You can't keep them. If Suffolk County would let cameras in there to interview him, he'd probably be doing interviews every night with his lawyer throwing grenades at the media to keep him away. He wouldn't care. He'd do it in a heartbeat if they'd let him. This is why they, once they get caught, the attention is what drives them. And let me tell you, he's not going to live a bad life in jail. He's getting along just fine in there. He doesn't have to stress about the mortgage or the electric bill or getting caught anymore. He's living the life of Riley over there, walking around. He's the big man on campus. He's the most famous guy. His biggest problem in jail is someone might just want to take him out just for the notoriety of taking him out.
Yeah.
So
and
he's a big fat guy, okay? And there's little skinny guys that whip that ass all day long over there.
Paul Giolino, man, there's one of a kind. I love this guy already. Paul, who's the most notorious serial killer that you've interfaced with?
Well, I never represented any. I've done a lot of criminal defense work. I've had no serial killers. I had some gang members who could be considered serial killers. They got 15, 20 bodies under their belt, but it was business and not, they weren't driven by sex or power. People who kill so willingly are just, there's a black hole in them, man. There is evil in this world. I'm a true believer in it. And this guy, the DNA is going to be tough to beat. Of course, there's the whole thing. How was it collected? You know, was it contaminated? But I mean, when you have three or four hits in it, they have a positive ID on this guy. They call it the CSI effect in at trial, and Randy can tell you all about it. I mean, juries love CSI now. They love it, love it, love it. And you get a scientist who's worth half a damn, and he can testify clearly and succinctly and put the science in plain language, that jury will be out about 35 minutes. See you later.
By the way, two of my favorite people, Sarah and MC, I mean, Mick Spunky, that was a joke, MC. I'm going to call you MC from now on, though. Sarah, Ski Hat Sarah and Mick Spunky. We've got Sky Ricky, Lorna McKenzie, Copper Horse from New Jersey, Crime Geek, Yala. All of them are friends of STS Nation. Look at this. Lisa became a YouTube member. COE, I'm going to have you queue up this Laura thing. We're going to play it in 1 second. But real quick. Paul, it was so interesting you just said that. We've had Larry Levine on, who's a well-known former inmate. I used to call him ex-cons and was told that that is politically incorrect. So he's now a former inmate because we live in a woke society. And he told me flat out, he said, when I was in prison, it was some of the best years of my life. No mortgage, no taxes. He was just hanging out in prison. So I thought that was really interesting coming from a guy like me, who has a tendency to stress about things in life. I thought that was an interesting take, but I have no plans to go to prison. I will not do well there.
our boy Sam Bankman, not to get off subject, I think he's going to do just fine in prison.
You do? That's interesting. That's interesting. We'll have to check that out. COE, can we, let's play Laura's piece. This is Laura inside the Yaphank jail, I believe it is.
We are inside the Suffolk County Correctional Facility, and this is a very similar setting to where the inmate, Rex Huerman, the Long Island serial killer suspect, is being held. It's in a different building, but very similar to this. This is the day area, and you see these chairs behind me. That is where the inmates watch TV. And then over here, you've got an exercise yard. You can probably see the basketball. It has a basketball court. And then over here is where inmates can make phone calls. And everything is recorded that happens on these phone lines. The cells are up there, and we've been hearing overhead announcements throughout the day, and we're going to bring you more about what life is like behind bars for the Long Island serial killer suspect.
And, Laura, that's both cool and eerie. Number one, I cannot get over that basketball court, because on the video, it looks incredibly nice. Is it actually nice, that basketball court?
You know, it's not bad. And if you go to my Instagram, Laura Ingle TV, I am loading up a ton of video that we did not have a chance to get to on News Nation, which, of course, you can watch. You're going to watch tonight, Ashley Banfield, in the 10 o'clock hour for more of our reporting. And you can always go online as well. But that basketball court, we got in there. And you know what's really interesting is not only the cells, but there's the windows are not real windows. They're opaque. So if you're in a cell, you can't see daylight. You can't see if the sky is blue or if the clouds are out. It's a really eerie feeling inside of the cell. In the basketball court, they rolled up the doors and there was a little bit of daylight that you could see. It's rather large. And for Rex Huerman, that is where he can go and do his laps. He's just walking around by himself. When he comes out and sits in those chairs to watch TV, it is a bailiff that will hold the remote and change the channels for him. He doesn't just sit there with a remote in his hand. So that was interesting to watch. And again, he is kept by himself. He's not out in general population. They don't want anything to happen to him. The sheriff said, look, we want justice in the courts, not here in the jail. So we're going to keep him separated for as long as that is needed. But one thing I wanted to go back to about the reading, you guys were talking about what he's reading about himself. And a lot of what he's reading are the legal documents that have been provided to him through his lawyer. And we were in court last week. I got to see him for the first time. And when I was in court, the two of the sisters of two of the victims were sitting right behind me. And it was really interesting to watch them watch him, because remember, he taunted one of the sisters. He called Amanda, one of the sisters of the victims, with her sister's cell phone and taunted her. So Amanda's sitting there behind us, listening to him tell the judge how much time he's spending in the law library, talking about what he's viewing and reading about. And I'm wondering, can she recognize that voice? Because the killer called her from her sister's cell phone repeatedly. I think it was up to six times that he called her. And the other point I want to note is that during the investigation, we learned that he was Googling a lot. You guys are talking about what he's reading about himself, right? This is a suspect, but he is Googling the Gilgo Four. He's on the Gilgo News website. He actually Googled some of the information that one of my former producers had put out into the world, articles that she had written, the podcast, you know, he might have listened to yours. He was actively not only searching for escorts, he was actively searching news about the Long Island serial killer before his arrest.
I was going to say, just to be clear, that's all before the arrest. Do we know right. Do we know what he's watching in jail on a daily basis?
You know, I saw the list, the menu list of the channels. They need to get News Nation on there. But I was looking at the list of channels. It's mostly sports and news. They wouldn't tell us what he's looking at. I asked about the books that he's checking out of the library. He has the law library, but there's the other one as well. And they said he's checking out fiction. I asked for some of those titles. They couldn't give that to me. But he's doing a lot of reading. He has the time to do it.
And Laura, you know we want you to stick around, but I know you have another job. So you are more than welcome. I'm going to keep you muted till we come back to you. If you have to jump, just give us a wave. But Randy, hypothetically, you're his criminal defense attorney. We know you're not, but he's sitting in there and he's the majority of the time when he's not sleeping, he's reviewing his case. What do you think he's doing? I mean, he's obviously an intelligent guy because he's an architect. You don't become one without an education. So he's not, you know, a dum-dum. But what do you think he's doing in that jail cell as it pertains to reviewing the case?
Well, it may come as a surprise to your viewers, but in my 35 years of doing this, clients make cases. It doesn't matter how good of a defense attorney you are. It doesn't matter how good your investigators are, your profilers, your team, none of that matters if you don't have an engaged client.
Yep.
Remember, nobody knows more about the case than the client. So you need to be able to rely on the client, whether it's for an alibi, whether it is to explain why your cell phone was pinging at a particular place at a particular time. You need the client to help explain the DNA evidence. We know how damning DNA evidence is because DNA evidence puts me at the scene of the crime. So in an instance, in a case like this, unless there is a good explanation for the DNA evidence, so let's say, for example, the defense is, yes, I had sex with this woman. I didn't kill her. That could be an explanation as to why my DNA might be found on someone. Now, that may or may not work depending on whether or not, based upon what the person was wearing, based upon other factors, is it plausible that my DNA evidence could be on someone, but I didn't kill them? But put that aside for the moment. In this particular case, the defense could be that the DNA cannot be trusted as much as we have that CSI moment, equally so. The defense in this case is going to be all about how Suffolk County botched and botched and botched and botched this case, how they cannot be trusted, how what they did was, to put it kindly, sloppy. Remember, during the time of these cases, you had an administration in Suffolk County that was corrupt, that the district attorney of Suffolk County ended up going to jail. The police chief of Suffolk County ended up going to jail. So Mike Brown is going to spend days, if not weeks, getting one juror to doubt whether or not that DNA evidence was planted, whether or not that DNA evidence was created in order to get Rex Heuermann. And Mike Brown is going to have a running head start because of the debacle of an investigation. Years and years and years and years went by where witnesses were ignored, where evidence was ignored. And now, again, you have an administration that was just a poster child of corruption.
And one of the reasons I love doing this show is guys like Randy Zellin, who's obviously a brilliant mind when it comes to being a defense attorney. You can see his mind working in real time. And Phil Ramos, by the way, Diana Johnson says maybe he was meeting with his architect partner. That would be the other person. However, the partner is his daughter, as far as I know. And we'll let Laura clarify that in a minute. But Phil Ramos, you just heard a very savvy defense attorney say, yeah, there's DNA. They're going to say he had sex with this sex worker back in the day, and that's why his DNA was there. What are you doing as an investigator to ensure that they can't just say that?
Well, it all depends on what type of DNA they've collected. There's various different kinds of DNA. There's bodily fluids that one would expect during a sexual encounter versus skin samples under a victim's fingernails. So it depends on what kind of DNA they're using to get their hits, so to speak. Science is pretty hard to beat. It's hard to beat the DNA. So when you can't beat the DNA, you go after the DNA collectors, which Mr. Zellin was alluding to. I don't know the aspects of the corruption back there. I can't speak to that. I'm not aware of what it is, but all it takes is one juror to sit back and go, wait a minute. So the chief of police was accused of doing this and he got whatever he was convicted of. But then you got to come into play. Well, how does that affect the detective that's investigating a murder separated from the staff, from the administration?
Let me just jump in for 1 second, because I think it's worth noting. At one point in time, that former chief of police that ended up going to jail, I think was actually a suspect.
A suspect in what?
In these murders.
Yeah. Oh.
And he was soliciting sex, by the way, from a male prostitute, which is why he's in jail, which is...
Well, he's out now, but when he was in... I mean, it was all sex related. And at one point in time, I do believe he was thought of as a suspect. So what happens is the corruption, to me, it's not merely throwing spaghetti up against the wall and seeing if it sticks. It's in fact that the spaghetti is part of the bigger picture at the dinner table, because the corruption actually leaks into this case.
You know what? I want to get Laura. What is your take on that? Because there's plenty of corruption. And then right, we'll get to some of these comments. They're commenting about the jail. Did they want to know if they furiously cleaned the jail before they let you in? It looks pretty nice. Do you know if they were cleaning for you, Laura?
All of the jail cells that we saw during our visit. And again, this is the newer one that we went to. There's two that are mirroring each other. And so he's at the older one that has the actual bars on the doors. We were at the newer one that has the sliding doors. So they were all pretty clean. And I think that they do keep them that way to answer that question. As far as James Burke, who you guys are talking about, you're right. I mean, he was, a lot of people thought for this guy for sure, he has been covering it up. He's been keeping the FBI out for years. He's got to be involved. But, as we've learned through his most recent arrest and through other people that have come forward, he was dabbling in prostitution himself, of hiring prostitutes, and he did not want people to know he had that lifestyle. But one of the reasons he went to jail was because he beat the living daylights out of a guy named Chris Loeb, who had broken into his truck and stole a bunch of stuff out of it. And some of that stuff was porn related and erotica related. And when they arrested Chris Loeb, brought him into jail, he said, "Let me get a crack at this guy." And he beat him within an inch of his life. I mean, he's, you know, the pictures prove it. And he did get busted for that. And that is one of the reasons why he went to jail. But that is the interview to get, right? That's somebody that I would love to speak to, James Burke, and say, what do you have to say now that there is somebody else in custody? Because there's been documentaries, podcasts, and all kinds of films made about James Burke possibly being the Long Island serial killer, whether or not he had anything to do with these murders and the others, we still don't know. And I also have a question for you guys about the guns, because we've been talking about the large amount of guns that Rex Heuermann had in his home. And investigators have said they don't believe that any of those 287 guns were used for these murders. But we don't know if they were used to, you know, to coerce these ladies in any way, right? Especially if they didn't fire the gun. And a lot of these guns were really old. They were antiques. They were Civil War relics. They didn't even, some of them didn't need permits. He had permits for 92 of them. But that's an interesting part that we really only the killer knows is if the guns were used in the
Randy, that's crime. Randy, that's kind of your world there. Is that something that the government might use to say that he was, you know, they potentially was using these weapons to coerce these women into certain acts and then ultimately
kill them? I think the difficulty there is going to be that obviously the victims who were murdered can't speak. And witnesses. We know no evidence that would be admissible to demonstrate that through the killings that any of these guns were connected, whether it be as the cause of death, or to take these women against their will. So I think you can throw that out. Now, to the extent that Suffolk County is actively investigating and speaking to other sex workers in an effort to connect living sex workers to Mr. Heuermann, I would imagine the question will come up. Well, did he ever show you a gun? Did he ever point a gun at you? Did he ever make you do anything against your will because he had a gun? Now, if any of those sex workers who are still alive can connect a face and can connect a gun, well, that is connecting the dots, and that's how we create circumstantial evidence. Again, I may be in a room with no windows, so I don't know if it's raining outside. But if someone walks into my room wearing a raincoat that's wet with a wet umbrella, I can reasonably infer that it's raining outside. That's circumstantial evidence. So, again, to me, the guns, I really hate to say this and I hate to sound cold as a criminal defense attorney, but to me, this case has reasonable doubt built into it. And if you make this case and make this trial about not the horror of a serial killer, but the horror of the botched investigation. And now, instead of having a target and shooting at the target, and that's where the bullet ends, that's where it is on the target, you shoot that bullet first and then draw the target around, the defense is going to be that you drew a target after you figured it was Rex Heuermann. And that's not the way we do things. And I think there is built-in reasonable doubt because, A, you have a great number of victims, which he's not being charged with. You've got the Suffolk County corruption. You've got the botched investigation. You've got a chief of police who is actually a suspect. And one juror is all it takes. And believe me, the DA's office does not want a mistrial. A mistrial in this case would be almost as bad as an acquittal.
By the way, there's someone in STS Nation right now going, hey, I wonder what Joel is stressing out about tonight. And I'll tell you, they got four amazing guests and making sure that they get equal time. So there's always something to stress about. Paul, by the way, the jail reminded me of when I was working at Fox News Channel, like Laura Engel did. And it was a disaster, an absolute mess, an animal house, if you will, papers everywhere. I won't mention names of reporters. You literally couldn't open office doors. And then every once in a while, they would send out an email saying, Mr. Murdoch's coming for a visit. And within 30 minutes, that place was so shiny and clean. Rupert worked in the same building as Laura. So I don't know if they went through that, but anytime he came to Washington, D.C., we had to clean up. By the way, Ned Smith with a funny comment. When the emergency alert system happened today, can you imagine all seven of Rex's phones going off? That it scared me today when it happened. I was at a food court. You heard 10 million phones. But Paul, to you, just to round out the jail stuff here. So the sheriff admitted that at the beginning, he was just kind of laying in this bunk, either staring at the ceiling or on his side with his back to the wall. And all he was pretty much that he was doing was sleeping. He's no longer on suicide watch, which he was on. He's now able to have bed sheets and his lovely green jumpsuit. As Laura mentioned, he's not in Gen Pop. He has a dedicated guard. He's in a 60 square foot cell. He's reading these books from the library. He's meeting with his chaplain and his lawyer. Zero visits from his wife and children. What do you think, realistically, and there are the photos, what do you, you know, because you're a profiler, what do you think is going on in his mind when he wakes up? Most of us would feel guilt and remorse. I assume that's not the case with him.
Not even close. No guilt, no remorse. No, I feel sorry for these poor girls. Listen, he's acclimating to his environment, and his a good lawyer, defense lawyer, and defense investigators, they get in there early and often and straighten him out as to the facts of life. Like, you're never coming out of jail, pal, while this is pending. Not going to happen. There's going to be no bond. So get used to your surroundings. Make the best of it. I don't know if he's in protective custody, which would change things a great deal. It doesn't sound like it if he's using the law library. He just might be like in the snitch or the pedophile ward where they're all kind of watched closely. And so he's with a bunch of sex offenders and snitches, and there's not much chance anyone will get hurt on that wing. So I think he's doing just fine. And I think his lawyer is probably doing a great job of managing him. And you alluded to it earlier. I've never met a stupid architect. This guy is not dumb. He's very bright. He's very literate. I've read articles where he just drove the city of New York crazy. He knew the regulation housing codes better than the housing inspectors. So this is a guy who's going to study up on his case. He's going to know the science. He's going to contribute. Randy's absolutely 100% right. If you have a client who's plugged in, who's contributing, who's bright, that's a big help. And it takes a lot of stress off defense team as well, because you don't have to worry about him sitting there carving hearts into the bench with a paper clip, or, you know, making eyes at the good looking female media people in the courtroom or the jurors, or doing something inappropriate that'll get him in trouble with the jurors. This is not a lay down. I think Randy's right. I think a lot depends on the judge, you know, and most judges I know are like the third prosecutor in the room. They're generally not going to let anything in there that's going to hurt that case too badly. You don't like it, see you at the appellate court. That's their general attitude. So it depends what this judge is going to let in, and so much as former corruption and how bad they botched things and how tight the government's case is against them. Are they just going to stick to these four cases with DNA? Are they going to limit, you know, what they charge him with eventually, or take the trial? I mean, if they're smart, you know, they go down to the buffet line and pick out the best pieces of meat and seafood, and they stick with that and don't wander off into areas where they could get, you know, terrorized because of bad police work, corrupt police work, et cetera. There's a whole thing going on here in the background that people aren't aware of. And, that, you know, the biggest thing is money. How much money is the government going to give this guy to defend himself? Because I could tell you, Suffolk County, they'll bust the budget on this one. If they have to spend $20 million, they'll spend $20 million. He doesn't have that luxury. His lawyer isn't going to be able to hire the best and the brightest. And it's he might get a lot of breaks because it's a high-profile case. He might get a lot of local, really bright scientists and stuff that might work for a very reduced rate for the publicity of being involved in this case, et cetera. But they're going to be at a distinct disadvantage cash-wise. And I got to tell you, in most criminal cases, cash is king. That's why the federal government wins 98% of the cases that go to trial.
That's an excellent point. Excellent point. I'll circle back to that to get Randy's take on that. But back to Laura here. Laura, Millie D. says, I used to be a deputy in a county jail. If he is on keep separate status, he is in lockdown, not in an open pod with a TV area. Do we know exactly how this is defined in Suffolk County? What is the exact verbiage that they're using in terms of his incarceration right now?
They just told us that he is not, he's not anywhere near general population. And when it is his time to come out and exercise, and when it is time to go to the law library, somebody comes and gets him, escorts him, and he gets to have that time outside of his cell that is allotted to him by the sheriff. So I don't know what the exact verbiage is, but that is what they told us, is that when he comes out, he sits down, the bailiff uses the remote, he gets to pace around the basketball court, and then he goes back in. And one other thing I want to mention about, speaking of visitors, we learned that he did get another visitor, but it wasn't a real visit. Somebody came and personally served him divorce papers. He got served on September 22nd. That news just coming to light this week. It is not going to be a contested divorce. I spoke to attorneys today about how this is going to be handled. It's going to take several months, 3 to 6 months, probably is going to go until next year, until this divorce is finalized. But that was an interesting note that he got served papers here just a few weeks ago to get his divorce going.
Excellent. And he is, as you said, he is not going to contest it. Right. Laura, what was it like to just, I mean, from a personal standpoint, to walk in the same hallways as a serial killer, especially being a woman? What was it like? Were there prisoners around you, by the way, other prisoners, and how were you treated in there?
There were other prisoners, and we were, again, this is two separate units that mirror each other. So we were going through the hallways, and after you go through security, I didn't see any prisoners going into the yard where you saw that stand-up that I had done. There were prisoners that were on the top floor and the bottom floor watching us film. We were not allowed to film them, nor would we want to. But they were watching our every move. So that was a little weird, just because, you know, you've got these people that are locked up watching you, and I could see them tracking us as we were moving back and forth between the basketball court and the jail cells. And we were looking at the shower, we were looking at the TV, we were looking at the little pull-up bars, and we had guys that were kind of standing at their jail cell like this, looking out at us. So
Laura, you made their year in the county today.
So, and then as we were leaving and we said our goodbyes, we were walking down the hallway and I saw two guys in the jail jumpsuits. And I said to the man that was escorting us, I said, there's two guys that are out. And he said, they're fine. But as we were approaching them, they each put their backs against the wall, eyes up. They wouldn't look at us. And I guess that's standard procedure. Those are probably, you know, minimum security, out on good, they get good behavior. They get to get out of their cells and help out or whatever. But I saw two that were actually out of their cells, backs against the wall, eyes averted as we walked by them.
One of their names was not Danilo Cavalcante, was it?
I don't believe so, no.
Phil Ramos, you were kind of nodding your head when you heard that. What is that all about when you put your back to the wall and avert eye, like make an eye contact? What does that mean?
It's like being in boot camp. They're told don't make any contact with anyone. If you do, then you're going to get some bad boy time for that. And it's to avoid situations just like we're talking about. It's showing respect to the people that are coming through there, because they're given a little bit of leeway. You know, the old term of a trustee being in jail, they're given a little bit of leeway. They might throw them an extra sandwich or something like that, or a little more free time, but they have to abide by the rules too. You standing up and looking straight ahead, they don't want any indication that this guy was looking at this pretty lady going by like this, and you know, next thing you know, he's in his cell all by himself. So that's pretty much standard protocol in most facilities like that.
Randy, I want to get, by the way, Yala says back to the wall equals submission. That's like when I make my dog Ethel lay on her back, same thing. Randy, what about the point that Paul just made, that basically the government has substantially deeper pockets? There's no way Rex is going to be able to, keep up financially, despite being an architect and having made a good living. And they want this guy convicted, obviously. It would be a huge black eye for Suffolk County. What about that? I mean, how big a disadvantage is it when you go up against the government?
Well, unfortunately, I think for the taxpayers of Suffolk County, Mr. Heuermann, his lawyer is appointed. So the government will be paying his lawyer's fees. His lawyer will have the ability to make an application for any resources that he reasonably needs to defend Mr. Heuermann. And that means investigators. That means experts. You simply fill out an application. You say, Judge, I need this. I need this so I can provide a competent defense for my client. The judge will approve it. And Mr. Heuermann will have all of the resources that he needs in order to adequately defend himself. So in a very weird way, not having any money and not having sufficient resources, if in fact he is appointed counsel. Once he's appointed counsel, then that playing field gets leveled significantly because it's the taxpayers who are going to be paying the bills for the experts and the investigators and all of the stuff that he needs to be able to beat back the prosecution.
Snap Happy just saw this comment and love to get Paul's take on this, and then we'll pivot to Mr. Ramos. Snap Happy, I'd like to see what a psych eval says about him. By the way, Paul is in Chicago, the Windy City, where it is still balmy and the sun has set, which is why he looks substantially darker than he did at the beginning of the show. Paul, what do you think his psych eval looks like?
Well, his psych eval, this guy's a hot mess. I'm sure it's going to be all kinds of personality disorders, and he'll be of high IQ. He'll cooperate with a psych eval. He'll try to outsmart the psychologist. They'll test him till the cows come home, and they'll come up with a number of diagnoses on him, mostly probably personality disorder would be the big one from everything I've seen and read about him so far. You know, I mean, he's not going to be a paranoid schizophrenic. There's not going to be any serious mental health issues. I don't think defense is going to try and play that card. It'd be a dumb card to play, in my opinion. So I don't think a psych eval is going to help the defense at all in this case. And I don't think we'll see much psychological testimony with regard to the crime.
By the way, I just saw this comment from Allie B in Tennessee. This is an awesome panel. I would do a super chat, but I got laid off a month ago and still searching for a new position. So for the first time, I'm super low on cash, but I do love this channel. That's honestly all that matters. If you can give us, five stars on Apple, as I said, that goes a long way, but we're pulling for you. Sometimes it is brutal out there, and this is one of these times the economy is starting to turn. So
just tell Allie we're all independently wealthy. We don't need the dough. We're fine.
Paul sends me money every month. And Ski Hat Sarah here. Allie, it's the best channel. Thank you, Ski Hat Sarah. So Detective Phil Ramos, former undercover narcotics, detective homicide, you name it. Phil Ramos has done it. Well, now the government, I'm sorry, investigators, law enforcement, they are interviewing female Long Island inmates who previously worked as escorts. They say that they've interviewed 120 female inmates and 10 of them had encounters with Rex. What about this strategy to go into the same facility that Rex Heuermann is in and speak to former sex workers who have come in contact with him?
Well, that's something that you'd expect them to do. Not only that facility, but any other facilities where sex workers might be housed at this particular point. And they may even reach out to current sex workers that are, you know, friendly with law enforcement that will pass information on, and it's a good technique so that you can establish his habits, his MO. Did these other girls have intimate contact with him? And if so, why did they not end up out in the beach somewhere under bushes? All of that is meant to try and get a good profile of what's going on in this guy's head. And, you know, there's no telling. You know, I think both Mr. Zellin and Paul mentioned his ego is what's driving him right now. All this is going to get caught up to him as the as the investigation progresses, more evidence is revealed. Sometimes it's going to take a lot longer to get the DNA on the other victims, and that may be why he hasn't been charged with any of the other deaths yet. But that's just a matter of time. If there's a nexus between all the other girls and the ones that he's been charged with, they're going to find it. A competent investigation will find it, and additional charges may very well be coming down the road.
This is interesting, Counselor Zellin. So as I was just saying, they are now interviewing these former female escorts. Most of them are in there for drug charges, they said. They say that he was both violent and aggressive, but left them frightened and not injured. Two of them said that they were intimate with him. How do you defend this in a court of law? I mean, I'm assuming you're going to say, yeah, he scared him, but he didn't do anything beyond that. How would you?
You just said it. I mean, to me, I embrace that. Now, we have to get into the weeds a little bit about technicalities. First of all, will the judge allow any of what we call that prior bad act evidence to come in? Because the court's going to be very mindful of not having the jury convict, if they convict, based upon what we call a propensity. If you did something someplace else at a different point in time, then you must have done it here. We don't convict people on that. The classic case these days that we all remember about piling on a defendant is Bill Cosby. So here, the first question is any of that evidence, to the extent that the investigation reveals that Mr. Heuermann had been violent with other sex workers, will that come into court? And quite frankly, as I started to say, if it doesn't, Joel, you said it, I would embrace that. To me, that's additional reasonable doubt. And I would agree with it and agree with it and agree with it for the simple reason that my client didn't kill any of these women. So, and then I sit down.
Interesting. Well put. I love the way Randy's brain works. It's wild. By the way, Randy could have also been a billionaire salesman, because whatever he says, I'm pretty much buying, because he's very convincing. Laura Engel, this is interesting, and I want to ask Paul about this as well. But, you know, authorities basically admitted that they moved in when they did, and we've now seen that famous Midtown arrest where they circle him on the sidewalk and arrest him. But they admit that they were fearful he was going to kill again. Has any of your reporting kind of pointed to that? I mean, was law enforcement getting worried? Was there a particular reason they went in at this time?
Well, they know, they've come out and said that he was contacting escorts just before his arrest. They were monitoring those phone calls. Of course, that has not been made public. We don't know what was said on those phone calls. It sounded as though they were alluding to, at least, that he was getting ready to hook up with some other ladies. But what that was going to entail, they moved in, I think, because they didn't want to chance it, right? They didn't want to give him any other opportunity to potentially cause anybody harm. And about those female inmates that have been interviewed, it's gone beyond that. It's also other, you know, the inmates that are here at the jail behind me, but also their friends, their community, the sex worker community. And they have to be very careful about the women that they're talking to. They do listen to them. As you mentioned, 120, several of them have said, yeah, they've shown him a picture and said, I know that guy. I was with that guy. And they're asking him about violent and abusive encounters. But the sheriff also said, look, we know that people might tell us that they have been with this guy, you know, to maybe earn some points, to maybe get some, as you guys have said, some, you know, time, an extra sandwich or whatever. But they are taking it with a grain of salt and really looking into it. But once they have somebody who said that they've been with them, they go back and they're looking at their phones. They're trying to see if they match any of the burner phones that Rex Heuermann had. So there is that work that is being done as well.
By the way, I just noticed my handiwork. I have accidentally cut my dear mother out of the background. You can only see her finger wagging at me. And she's going to be pissed, and she's going to tell me that. And I was editing. I got my book back from the editor. Big news. And I'm going through the edits. let's put it this way. Carm is now trying to convince me to play her down a little bit. And when she told me that, I don't know how to say this without getting myself or her in trouble. Basically, Carm read the first chapter. And now that it's in the edit process, she expletive at me. Get rid of that. Lose this. You better expletive. And she had the audacity to say, instead of using the expletive, use the word buzz off, because she heard me say that. And I said, there's no way I'm writing a book that does not represent you in an authentic way. So Carm lost that battle, but there's certain things that she is making me get rid of, because even at 84 years old, Paul, I don't know if you know this, my mom's a Holocaust survivor. I've written a book about her. It's coming out. Same title as the podcast. And I promised her I would remove a couple of things, but there's no way I'm switching the way she actually talks to me, which is 1,000 times worse. And people who are at CrimeCon, Scott Duffy and others, can attest to the fact that that is true. By the way, if we don't sell 1 million copies of this book and make it a New York Times bestseller, you're never seeing Joel again. That's going to be the end of me. So we're gonna all work. And you guys are going to help me spread the word.
I guess there's going to be an opening real soon then, because almost nobody sells 1 million copies anymore.
I have right now my mother's screaming, what is it? You have expectations. Paul, to you, would he have killed again?
Absolutely. Okay. Given opportunity, time, effort. He's a killing machine. Hey, this is what serial killers, this is what they do. They are evil and they kill. So given the right opportunity, somebody would have wound up dead had they not taken him off the street when they did. And Laura was absolutely right on the money. They're taking a big chance once they identified him, letting him run around free still, because you could watch all the TV in the world you want, and Phil will tell you, surveillances go bad all the time. And if he thinks he's under surveillance, he sometimes can elude it. And if something happens while he's not being surveilled, that one's going to be on the cops, and they weren't going to take that chance. I wouldn't. If I was a boss, I'm going to get this guy off the street right now. We got enough. Let's get him.
COE got nervous and immediately removed a comment that I won't repeat what the comment was, but it was kind of funny. Look at this from Heather N. Awesome guest, especially Mr. Ramos. Look at that, singling out Mr. Ramos, but he's a regular. And all the other guests are, look at him. Love it. So this was interesting, Randy Zellin, to me as well. So one of the attorneys for two of the victims' families, a guy named John Ray, I don't know if you know him, he's a defense attorney, again, representing both of the two of the Gilgo victims' families. When he was asked about them investigators interviewing these former escorts in jail, he said that everyone they're talking to is tainted because people in jail are looking to score points to get out. Is that a valid argument?
It's difficult, and it would be, I think, intellectually dishonest to say that people in jail, what we call the jailhouse snitch, don't give away information for free, because oftentimes they don't. They don't do it because they're altruistic. They don't do it because they want to see justice done. They don't do it because they have a guilty conscience. They do it because they want something in return. If they're in jail, they want to get out of jail. The easiest way to get out of jail is to cooperate. You say to law enforcement, I have information. Law enforcement says, well, what do you want in return? I want to get the hell out. So yes, it's quite easy for someone to say, yes, I know about this, or yes, I saw this. Listen, don't be surprised if one day somebody comes forward and says, I was in the jail with Rex, and Rex told me he did it, and he would have done it again. Whether or not that's true, whether or not it's credible, well, that's going to depend on the circumstances. But oftentimes, we do see people in jail who come forward only now because they want to get out of jail.
Phil Ramos, to you. So the DA has publicly, Ray Tierney, said that we are prepared to bring charges with regard to 3 out of the 4. We're working on the 4th. That would be Maureen Brainerd Barnes. And we've now expanded our investigation to include other bodies that were covered in that area. Do you expect, because Randy Zellin was making the point, and it looks like Paul just bounced out. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but very interesting guy. I'm definitely going to have him back. But Phil, do you expect other charges to come? And the point that Randy was making is if you can't pin him to all 11, you know, then who committed the other crimes? Henceforth, you didn't do the other three or four.
Well, that's part of gathering as much evidence as you can, because if you can say we've charged him with these four, but we haven't charged him with these five, that doesn't necessarily mean that he did or didn't do those other five. Somebody else could be responsible for those other five. But typically in serial cases of this type, there just may not be enough evidence to charge him. And you're only going to get one shot at charging the guy on another case, because you're taking a risk on we got a 70% chance of getting a conviction on this instead of 90-95%, because if you lose that one, then what does that say about the rest of them? So I don't think that they're waiting to charge. I hope that they are able to gather enough evidence to charge him with the others. But if they don't have that evidence, that doesn't mean that he didn't do them. They just don't have the evidence to charge him. And, you know, it could be fodder for the defense to say, well, you've got 10 victims over here. They all died in similar ways. How come you didn't charge him with all 10? Well, the answer to that is we didn't have enough evidence to charge him with all those 10. Not for lack of trying. The evidence just wasn't there to connect him with those other bodies. If there was evidence there that excluded him, then that would certainly be brought forward too. But you have to look down the road. If there's evidence there that excludes him, that means there's somebody else, another serial killer working out there. And if that's the case, you know, Mr. Zellman was right. There's a ton of reasonable doubt if that turns out to be the case.
I don't know if I'm delusional, because the COE is going to make fun of me when I get back from the studio. But a second ago, I didn't see Carm, but now I'm seeing Carm. So I don't know what's going on, COE, but you'll explain that to me. I'm sure I'm just losing my mind tonight. By the way, Allie B. from Tennessee, who courageously told us she just lost her job and is looking for another one, and she will find one. She gave us a 5-star rating on Spotify, which is, I love it, and it's very helpful for us in terms of getting advertisers and sponsorships. So if you can do that, again, it is much appreciated. Randy Zellin, I'm always hearing my mother's voice in my head, and she's telling me to stop saying that, which I'm going to do. I know you had a Jewish mother, so you know what I'm dealing with here. Not unlike, I guess, Italian mothers. But the quote from the assistant or Latino grandmothers, abuelitas for that matter. The quote from the assistant Suffolk County DA is, several of the firearms were apparently illegally possessed. For example, upon conversations with members of the Suffolk County Crime Lab and the Suffolk County Police Department who recovered the items but have not conducted a forensic examination, at least 26 unregistered guns, 15 unregistered assault weapons, and 10 high-capacity magazines appear to have been possessed in the defendant's home in violation of state firearms laws. Is this exactly what you were getting at, that they are basically – he had a permit for 92 of 287 guns. Is this what you're getting at, that they are building a case that kind of correlates with this one but is different in case they can't get the conviction on the murders?
I think so. Massapequa, where Mr. Huerman lived, is in Nassau County. That is why the Nassau County District Attorney's Office would be handling that investigation. I don't view it as a coincidence. I don't view it as anything other than just in case. Again, I mentioned Al Capone earlier. You couldn't get Al Capone what you wanted to get him on, so you got him on tax evasion. A conviction is a conviction. Jail is jail. My concern with this case, and it's one of the problems that we run into where what happens years ago ends up coming back to haunt those. And here, so much time was spent calling this Long Island serial killer, Long Island serial killing. When you talk about serial, you're talking about a signature. you're talking about, in all likelihood, the same person or the same group of people committing this crime. Now, all of a sudden, if you only have three that you can pin on one person, not part of a group, three out of 11, that is built-in reasonable doubt if you can't put the other eight on the same guy, because then you shouldn't be calling it a serial killer or a serial killing, because you've got these jurors who are not even juries yet, thinking one person did this. Now all of a sudden you're going to walk into court and say, forget about the other eight, forget about whether one person did all 11. Just focus in on these three or these four. That's not realistic. That's not, you can't take, like in Men in Black, you can't take the wand and flash the jurors so they forget what they've been hearing all of these years. And that's what concerns me.
Paul, question for you, and we'll start to wrap up. And by the way, I'm very glad you came back. I thought you were like, I hate this show. I'm never coming back. I'm just clicking right off. But I'm good to see you back.
Your shirt actually, a little bit, but I'm back.
And your shirt says embrace the suck. So you're dealing with STS. It's perfect. I love it. Paul, do serial killers, I mean this sincerely, do they care about their family members? And I happen to be friends with Kerry Rawson, whose father is Dennis Rader, the notorious BTK serial killer. And Kerry has made her own name because she's out there trying to help the victims' families. But a guy like Rex Shurman, and by the way, Kerry visited her dad and her dad broke down sobbing. But do you think a guy like Rex Shurman cares about his daughter and son and his wife, who he just putting through all this right now?
Well, I think they amazingly are good at compartmentalizing. So yes, I do think he cares about his children, probably unquestionably. And the BTK killer, which I've looked at long and hard over the years and discussed on various other shows, another evil guy, evil, 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 horrible human being. I do believe he loves his family. He had a whole life outside of what he was doing. I mean, like this guy, he's a professional architect. He's interacting with government officials every day of his life, almost clients. People who are paying him a lot of money to solve his problems. So, yeah, these people are fantastic at compartmentalizing the different sections of their life. I mean, his perversion was sex with hookers and killing them. And he was really good at it because he didn't get caught for a long time. At least he thought he was very good at it. He just didn't have the right detectives on him forever.
Paul, let me ask you a question. Seriously, when you're walking down the street because of all that you've seen and the fact that you've got this profiling background, I mean, how do you look at most people? Like, I mean, is there a curiosity? Are you constantly profiling people? Can you pick out from a mile away who doesn't fit in, who's a little out there, a little strange?
No, you can't pick them out. The obvious ones, the drug addled, the lunatics running around the streets. Yeah, those are easy, but I mean, most people conceal their dark side very well. And I've worked for some pretty notorious killers throughout the years as a defense investigator. And some of the nicest people you'd ever want to meet. Great to have drinks with, great to go to dinner with. But and you get on their bad side and you're going to wind up in somebody's trunk at the airport. So you just never know when that switch is going to get turned. And some people, let's face it, have no conscience. That's who they are. That's what they do. I can't tell you how many times I heard, hey, that's what I'm about. This is who I am. I don't apologize for it. This is how I've always been. And this is how I will be when they put me into the ground. So I'm suspicious of almost everyone until you prove you're not to be suspicious around me any longer.
And I got to ask Phil Ramos, but first, Analytical Blarney, AB, hey, Carm, market them the books. They will sell. Carm has no idea what she's in for. She's going on a worldwide media tour. I'm dragging her everywhere. If I have to put her in a suitcase, she's going to yell at me for that. Because last time I said I was putting her on top of the car and bringing her to Crime Con. By the way, offers.
Pat Conroy, the author?
Yeah.
The Great Santini?
Yeah, yeah.
It was based on his father. And when he started bringing his father on book tours, they quit talking to Pat. I'm dead serious. He was the star of the show. So watch out, or Karen will be running this whole gig in no time.
Trust me, she runs the show. It's already imploding on me, so it can only get worse. But needless to say, Karm is going to be on this book tour. Phil Ramos, and by the way, this is a super someone, Ned Smith, it's going to cost you a hell of a lot more than 10 bucks. Can you spill on how you met your gorgeous wife asking for a friend named Yala? I definitely cannot, but we just told Scott and Phil, that's how this all came up. And put it this way, they had a hard time believing what we were telling them. One day it'll come out. It's pretty crazy. It's not as crazy as you think it is, but pretty crazy. Phil Ramos, when you're going out, you can tell me, you don't have to tell anyone else. Number one, do you carry a firearm? Number two, are you always situationally aware? Are you always looking for, like when you go to a movie, are you looking at the exit? Are you looking to see if people don't fit in, if they're a little strange, if you need to, you know, keep your antenna up?
Yeah, you do. You do it surreptitiously, of course. You're not just eyeballing everybody that walks by, but it's just, you know, it's second nature. That's what you're trained to observe. You're supposed to watch what's going on around you. You know, I've said it before, it's situational awareness is what keeps you alive. You have to know what's going on around you, but keep it to yourself. You don't, you know, pull your wife and kids into it and say, hey, look at that guy over there. He's about to do something stupid. You just, you're just aware of your surroundings to the point where if something bad happens, you're the one that's going to have to react. And you got to be ready. You just got to be ready for anything that happens. And whether you decide to react or let somebody else react, that's going to be a decision that you have to make, you know, and pray to God you don't ever have to get in a circumstance like that. But if you do, if it presents itself, you need to be ready to do something. You can't let bad people run the world. And, you know, you see all these videos now of these takeover robberies and thefts of people going in and stealing thousands and thousands of dollars of merchandise. And what are the people standing around doing with their cell phones? Oh, look, you know, what the hell is wrong with people, man? Do something, you know, block the person getting away. I don't get it. But that's coming from, you know, 35 years of trying to stop people from doing the wrong thing.
And so it's a lot of,
you can't ask everybody to, you know, take some action, do something. But me personally, yeah, people would ask me, do you carry a gun? I said, every other day. And they go, well, what day is it today? I said, that's for me to know, man.
By the way, this comes from a guy who to this day still has carried out the largest undercover narcotics deal, $1 million through a casino. If you didn't see that episode, check out on the video tab, not the live tab, Surviving My Biggest Case with Phil Ramos. His career was wild, and he served his community and his nation. So we thank him for that. Beauty Biz Elite says, but I always say this, best guests, better community. Thank you so much, Mick Spunky, MC Spunky, for my membership. I'm a newer sub, and I love this channel. STS team, mods, fellow subs, and chats. Great to chat amongst some great, like-minded, beautiful people. Thank you for being here. MC, Mick, thank you for sponsoring that membership. Very kind of you. We're going to round out with this and some quick final thoughts. So Randy Zellin, Laura talked about this. We found out officially that he was served divorce papers in jail. So he did have that other visitor. He is not contesting the divorce. He signed an admission of service back on 9/22. She filed 6 days after the arrest. He says he has no intention to respond. He's basically letting it go. Is this, in your opinion, A, because she hates him, or B, because of financial reasons, or C, both of the above?
Yeah, I'm going to go with all of the above, and the financial piece of it being you don't get a free lawyer. The government doesn't pay for your lawyer when you want to get divorced. So there's an economic component to it. To the extent that his wife knows anything, and that might be covered by what we call the spousal privilege, Why annoy her?
That's right.
Whatever I got, it's yours, please. Right. I got enough on my hands right now.
Take it,
let
honey.
Let me tell you from personal experience, and this is coming from a guy, and I will say it out loud. I had to buy my wife some flowers today, which I don't often do, but I did it. And while I was in there, by the way, not one, not two, there were three other guys. This is only in Miami. I walk in through this door real quick. I don't see the florist. I Googled nearest florist wherever I was. I walk in. I got to take a picture of this place. It looked like a morgue. There's just a giant door, like a sliding door with a giant latch. And she's like, have you been here before? No, I haven't been here before. She opens it up. And then there's this crazily refrigerated, massive area with as many flowers as the eye can see. But the point of the story is there were three other dudes in there and myself. And I was telling her, I got in a little trouble with the COE. I got to get flowers. This whole backstory. The three other guys are like, either my girlfriend or my wife is so pissed at me right now. If I don't get these, but it was amazing. I thought it would be a great reality show. Guys in a florist have no clue what's going on, buying flowers to try to get out of trouble. That was my day today. Massive thank you to our amazing panel, Laura Ingle. She's going to be on Ashley Banfield tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern time. She was a Fox News correspondent for 20 years prior to that. She was at KFI. She was one of the people that helped break the Scott Peterson case. An amazing person at that. Randy Zellin, he is as good a criminal defense attorney as they come out of New York City. Not only did he do the show tonight, but he was in Denmark this morning, and the poor guy has COVID, an absolute mensch of a human being. Love Randy Zellin for doing that. Randy, where do we go from here legally?
Stay tuned. We're going to see arguments in court. We're going to see exchanges over whether discovery's been complete, whether there's more discovery that's going to be coming down the road. There'll be conversations about pretrial hearings. I mean, obviously, this case is not getting bled out. You're not going to see a Hunter Biden-esque sweetheart plea deal. There may be further indictments down the road if, in fact, there's more evidence linking him to additional bodies. You probably don't see a trial in this case in 2024. So, like I said, stay tuned.
Speaking of situational awareness, oh my God, for a second, I thought I saw someone was standing in the shadow behind Phil Ramos. Anyone else see that? That is Phil Ramos. Not only is there a cardboard cutout of Carm, there's a cardboard cutout of Phil Ramos, who, by the way, is a retired Las Vegas homicide detective, spent the better part of more than three decades keeping his community safe. He was at Tupac Shakur's autopsy. That's why we had him on for the Tupac show. Three-plus decade career. He also worked undercover narcotics, as you heard, infiltrated the Cuban mob. Three-time Las Vegas Police Officer of the Year and a native Las Vegan. By the way, Phil Ramos, I won't tell anybody, but I know you got tons of friends still in the department. Anything going on with that investigation? Rex Heuermann had ties to Las Vegas. Anything you can share with us? You're going to tell me to buzz off. That's fine. But that and your closing thoughts.
No, there's been no updates. And I think the DNA comparisons are not back yet. And like I said, sometimes you can get DNA in a week. Sometimes it takes a year. It's all a matter of how strong it is and how much you have. But I agree that Heuermann probably won't see a jury for at least a year.
Bundy data says only 5% of criminals do about 65% of violent crimes. That's an interesting stat. Ali B, the book is the same name as the podcast. It's not out, though, till Father's Day. Surviving the Survivor will have pre-orders well before then in, like, January. Paul's telling me you can't get to a million. I'm shooting for a million. Right now, again, Carm is screaming at the at her phone, which she's probably watching upside down. Paul Cialino. He was the first and remains the only private investigator to receive board certification as a criminal profiler from the Academy of Behavioral Profiling. He's been at this, I don't want to date him, since I think 1980 or 81. He is the current president of the International Association of Forensic Criminologists. He's also the past winner of the International Investigator of the Year, and he's also written a ton of books, probably sold 5 million of them. Paul, your final thoughts here. What do you think Rex, give us your final thoughts, but how about this question? What is Rex thinking about right now if he's not snoring?
Rex is probably reliving his fantasies of killing these girls and his sexual exploits with them. That's what drives these people. That's Rex's soul. That's who he is. That's what he's about. And he is reliving this stuff, and he's loving every second of this. Now, granted, he's in jail. He doesn't like it. If he doesn't like jail, wait till he gets to Attica. He's really going to dislike that place, okay? But he's going to get in line for everything over there, and he's going to be paying people to use the phone. I mean inmates, not the institution. So he better enjoy his time right now, because it's not going to get any better for him. But he is enjoying it. He likes the attention. He likes, you know, he loves meeting with the lawyer. He'll start acting like a lawyer in about 3 or 4 months. He'll be busting out all the legal terms with his own lawyer, and his own lawyer will have to have the heart to heart and say, hey, me lawyer, you client, okay? You're not an attorney. You read a few law books. Stop, all right, with your crazy legal theories. They're not going to work here. He's going to be showing up writing motions. It never ends, right? He's going to come in with motions. His lawyer's going to go, yeah, I'll look at that one. That's good. It's an illegal arrest. They couldn't, I've lived this for 40 years now, 40 plus years with these guys, and they never change. They're always the same. Rex is a happy guy, actually as happy as he can be in his current situation. He's not minding this at all. I'm telling you, he looks better even than when he first got arrested. Take a look at him now and look at when he got arrested. The stress has left the man. He's getting rid of the wife. All right. We know that's 70% of the stress.
No comment.
Right. Go get more flowers after this one.
Yeah.
I'm a 3-time loser. Okay. So I know what I'm talking about. And not the easiest guy in the world to get along. And I don't kill people on the side as a hobby.
That we know of. But you don't seem like it, Paul.
I haven't been indicted yet in any event. Close a few times, but not for that.
Well, what is his life going to be like in state prison? I mean, is he going to be in Gen Pop? Is he going to be a big target because he's a big guy?
Well, if he's smart, he goes to Gen Pop eventually, right? And just lives his life. Listen, here's the secret to prison. Keep your mouth shut and mind your own business, period. Okay, as long as you're not a sex offender, and he won't be considered a sex. When I say sex offender, rapist, child molester, etc., he will not catch heat for his crimes per se in prison. But he better not act like he's some kind of big shot, because he's not a gang member. He's not going to become a gang member. He's just going to have to mind his business, keep his mouth shut, and he'll be okay. He'll live out his life. And he'll be doing appeals for the next 15, 20 years. He probably won't live to see all his appeals finished. If New York is anything like Illinois, I doubt that. You got a death penalty in New York or not?
Randy, no, right? Yeah, no.
So, well, then he will see his appeals run out at some point. Then.
Unless they can get, Randy, unless there's a federal nexus somehow, right?
Yeah, but right now there's no conversation about that.
No, and there won't be. I worked on Timothy McVeigh's case, and it talk about well-financed, Randy. We were given the Black American Express card for the defense, literally. Mm-hmm. But that was the only case I've ever worked on where the judge said, yeah, if government's spending money, you could spend it. Local judges have a tendency to go, yeah, counselor, your rate's $500 an hour. Well, in this case, it's $125 an hour. And they do that all the time, and that's how they beat up the defense. It drives me crazy, because it should be even, but it's not. And I don't want anyone to get the perception that I strongly suspect that it will not be even, because the judge don't like him, and he don't want to take any heat for giving this guy, you know, the ultimate budget that he should have to defend himself. Frankly, if you're going to spend $10 million, you should be able to have an equal, you know, I mean, you shouldn't go to prison because you're outspent, is what I'm saying. And I'm always leery of county judges, district judges that control the purse strings. It's gonna be tough. It's an uphill battle, but Rex is where he should be. And let me tell you, he's gonna have it a lot better than any of his victims ever did.
That's for damn sure. Well put. Lest you think we're not a global show, Wesley John Holmes coming to us from Tokyo. STS raising the bar as usual. I can't get a much better panel than this. And look at this. Karen gave us 5 stars on Apple. Paul, if you refuse to come back on my show, at least grab a drink with me when I'm in Chicago so I can hear some stories. I hope you will do that.
Be glad to.
Okay. Does that mean you're not coming back on the show, or you are?
It's up and down right now. We'll have to negotiate a new price because the one tonight's lacking.
He's honest, at least.
Although I like Phil's cutout. Phil was worth the price of admission, so I'll be back for it.
I will definitely beg Paul to come back on. Quick programming note, tomorrow night we've got Sean Reck. If you don't know who he is, he directed the documentary White Boy, which is a huge hit on Netflix. And he also just directed Convicting a Murderer, what he believes is a true story about Stephen Avery. We've got him and Anjanette Levy, who covered the Stephen Avery trial for like 5 years. We have both of them on the show tomorrow night, special time, 6 p.m. Eastern time. And then Friday, we've got Great Scott, your true crime Phil. Until then, love you, America. Love you, Chicago. Love you, Las Vegas. Love you, New York, New Jersey, Tasmania, and everywhere near and far in between.